Okay, so how do I behave? The me that's me runs into the you that's you, and there's more of you than there are of me. So how do I work in a system? How do I work in a body? How do I work in a congregation? How do I get along in a community? It basically involves self-awareness becoming other awareness. It's the essential key to handling relationships, and it's the essential key to whether or not I'm a leader or I'm popular or I fit in well. It's the crux of being socially apt or socially inept, and basically what it boils down to. And in the church, you know, if you look at Romans 12, as you read through those sections, is a description of a spiritually mature person, and oddly enough, a mentally healthy person. And the key component of that is that middle section where it says you're the body. How do I deal with my role as it affects your role, and am I other aware, not just self-absorbed? Does that make sense? And then you go through the rest of Romans, and it's let love be without hypocrisy. I'm not using my emotions to manipulate people. And then how do I behave when other people don't behave? And go all the way down, all the way through, don't be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. And so Romans 12 is how spiritually mature people, and based on my unique worldview as a therapist, and how mentally healthy people behave. If you're not mentally healthy, you can't do those things. You have a true mental illness, or you're spiritually immature, one or the other. Pretty interesting. So other questions or clarifications? So let's look at Deuteronomy and talk about what I call conversational Christianity. You know, a lot of times we try to create a spiritual subculture in our house, and sometimes it seems like it backfires. Anybody ever had trouble doing family devotionals? Is that a yes? Because family devotions look like what? Look like miniature church. Dad stands up and goes, well, everybody's gathered together today. There's a few announcements. The dog needs to be fed. And then all of a sudden it's like we're in a little bitty church. And Dad's really awkward. So I learned this thing I call conversational spirituality at a retreat. Now, I was younger in those days. So, you know, when you're a young guy and you go speak at a retreat, Lonnie, we're so glad you're here. Everybody called me Lonzo in those days. Lonzo, we're so glad you're here. You bunk with the boys. When you get a little older, it's Brother Jones. We're glad you're here. We have a private cabin for you with air conditioning and a deadbolt. You know, but in those days, they bunked me with the kids. Well, if you sleep in a room with a bunch of teenagers, number one, get a top bunk. Get a top bunk in the corner. It's a fatal funnel. They can't get to you. And against camp rules, I always took a big knife. And you walk in, you're an older dude compared to kids, even if you're in your 20s, and they look at you like, oh, the old dude's here. You climb up on your bunk, you open up your stuff, you pull this knife out. You hang it on the rafters upside down. You lay down, you raise up and put your hand on it. And you do about two of those just so they know you can grab it. And you go, now if you boys will be real quiet tonight, I probably won't have another flashback. And you go to sleep and nobody bothers you. It's awesome. It's cool. They don't mess with your underwear. They don't hide your stuff. It's just good crowd control. So I'm at this camp. It's a camp for the deaf. I'm with the Gunnersville Church of Christ. And I just get to sleep. And I hear this voice go, hey, Lonzo. And you know better than look over the edge of the bed. That's how the monsters grab you, right? You know, you can't have your feet sticking out. I go, what? I need to ask you something. You know, what? He goes, what's your favorite Bible verse? I usually ask everybody I meet, and I forgot to ask you. Well, I crawl out of the bunk and sit down on this concrete floor that's covered in dirt. And I cut on my flashlight. I said, well, depends on the day of the week, but right now, this is my favorite Bible verse. And then a light came on over here, and a flashlight came on over here, and finally we just cut on the overhead lights, and a bunch of teenage boys sat in the floor, and we talked about the Bible, and it wasn't a Devo. We were talking about the Bible like you would football or NASCAR or hunting or fishing. The guy's name was Chad Smith that started the conversation. He's a retired police officer now, was a member of our SWAT team, was a sniper on our SWAT team, but he was a Christian way before he was a cop. He's one of my dear friends in the world. And this is basically what he was exemplifying when he had that conversation. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, the Shema. Hear, O Israel. The Lord our God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. They shall be as a sign for you in your hand. You will bind them between frontlets, between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorpost and on your house and on your gates. Making sure that our children are faithful in the next generation. When God told Moses, hey, we're going to make the next generation of Israel faithful, He didn't say, we're going to send them to you, Moses. It became the parents' job. Youth ministry is a supplement to parenting. It's not a substitute. And you've got to impress that upon the people at your congregation that, you know, your kids only get an hour and a half of me on Sunday or 45 minutes on Wednesday, but you're with them all the time. And so when you start thinking about how to have spirituality in my home, it's not that we have family devo time or family Bible reading time, but our spirituality is not compartmentalized. You talk about it when you get up. You talk about it when you lie down. You talk about it when you're walking on the way. It's on your bracelets, on your ball caps, it's on your t-shirts, it's on your fence post, it's on your car tag. I don't have any trouble telling you who the Razorback fans are. It's on their car tags and their flags in their yard. I don't have any trouble telling you who the Tennessee people are. I don't have any trouble telling you who the Roll Tide people are. Because we advertise that stuff. Well, what do we advertise in our kids about our spirituality? About our connection with God? And Jesus grew in wisdom, in stature, in favor with God, in favor with man. After He left temple. He's in the temple. He's with the doctors. He's with the lawyers. He's asking and answering questions. And He leaves the professionals. And He goes home with an obscure Jewish carpenter and probably for all practical purposes a 26-year-old Jewish girl. And He grew in wisdom and stature, favor with God and favor with man. It is not the job of the church to raise the children. It's the job of the home. And when it came time to put that burden on the next generation of Israel, He took it out of Moses' lap and put it on the parental lap. So unless we do a better job of making a what I call a Christian subculture in our home, then we're going to lose the next generation. Because a youth minister only has so much influence, a youth minister only has so much time. The deacons and elders have only so much influence and so much time. But you're spending an incredible amount of time with your children. And if church is something you turn on and something you turn off, when they get to college, guess what's easier to do with that? Turn off, don't have to worry about it. And so if we keep it so that it's a daily part of their life, that they look for God and they see God in all walks, when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk, it's on your gate, it's on your fence, it's on your brace, it's on your ball cap, it's on your t-shirt, and it's on the tag of your car. That's when we create a spiritual subculture in our home. And that's not necessarily sitting down having Bible study. You get in the car with your children and instead of asking, did you learn anything in Bible class today? And what's the answer to that, by the way? No. What'd you do? Oh, no. You get in the car and talk to your spouse about what you learned in Bible class today. What you thought you heard the preacher say. Now, you can't rip the preacher to shreds. You can't run him through the grinder. It's got to be this positive thing so that then if you're talking about that, guess what kids will do? They're going to join that conversation. Gunner, my 7-year-old grandson, did a project. Him and Rowan are a year and 16 days apart. They're in the same grade at school, which I don't know what genius decided to put the Nitro Circus in school together, but they did. And so Gunner's at my house. He's like, Papa Jonesy, I'm doing a project on the country of Belgium. And so I'm trying to be a good, involved papa. And so I go, oh, Belgium. So let's see. What do they export? He goes, they export chocolate. Oh, I love chocolate. That's what we talk about. Well, the little girl pops up. Well, Papa Jonesy, my country is Brazil. Because she wants to join in that conversation. And I'll go ahead and finish the story. I said, okay, well, tell me about Brazil. That's where my martial arts comes from. She goes, really? What do they export? And I said, putting fools to sleep. I got a call from her mother. Do not help the children with their school projects. So apparently that little six-year-old granddaughter stood up in front of a room full of little kids in a private school and said, and we put fools to sleep. And they will call you anyway, but if you engage with your kids will engage with you, but you do that by engaging. Because if you say, this is what I learned, this is what I studied, this is what I liked, children learn by imitation, and they imitate us. And that's how you engage them in a spiritual subculture and a spiritual self-identity. And we've got to be super careful. I'm not going to harp on it, but be super careful. You don't have an A student, a B student. You don't have a C student. You don't have a baseball player, football player, soccer player, or cheerleader. You have God's student. And they make A's, B's, or C's. You have a godly student who plays football, basketball, or cheers, or marches in the band. And help them understand that their identity is in God and Christ, not in these activities they do. And a scary thing to do as a youth minister was always sit down in the room with the parents and go, hey, I just need to kind of know where I'm at, you know, what the waters are like. Write down the five most important things stressed at your house. Well, parents know this is a church class, so you know what they write down? God, Jesus, church, and the apostles, right? Then you sit down in a room with teenagers and say, tell me the things you hear most at your house, the five things most stressed at your house. Make good grades, get a good job, cut your hair, get off the phone, right? And you go, okay, this is what you think you're telling your kids. This is what your kids say they hear all the time. Now, that's not up to me to fix because I don't live there. That's up to you. And you might be interested in doing that survey or taking that survey with your youth group to see about this spiritual subculture. Cool. Questions, comments, anything I need to add on? So, in the list, I'm capable. We're going to teach competency in Scripture. We're going to help them learn to read and study, understand and apply Bible on their own. Then we're also going to let them do some things for themselves. You know, if we're going to have a lock-in, let them decorate it. We're going to have a thing, let them plan the agenda. Involve them in as many things as you can involve them in where they get to make the decisions and do their things. I was a Lads to Leaders student for just a few years. Brother Zorn, the guy who started it, was the preacher at my church. And in those early days, there was no convention. Nobody ever went to Nashville or anything like that. He says, I need five of you young boys to write sermons, and I've got it arranged that you can preach in Crestview, Florida on this Sunday. Now, you got to figure out where Crestview, Florida is. You got to figure out how many miles it is. You got to figure out how much money you need in gas to get there. And you got to figure out how many nights you need to stay at a hotel. And you need to earn the money to do it. And every week we'll check on your progress. And by the time I was 12 years old, I could plan a trip. Because Brother Zorn said, if you're going to be guys who preach the gospel and lead the church, nobody's going to do this for you. You got to do it yourself. Hey, it's 235 miles to Crestview, Florida. We're going to need this many tanks of gas. Gas is as much money. And before I got in the high school, I could plan a trip and a retreat because I knew about schedules and functions. And that's what we did with Lads to Leaders. It wasn't just the things that we... And I'm not saying what they do with it now is bad or anything. It's gotten so big you probably couldn't do that. But those are the kind of things. And we learned to be capable. We learned that hey, we want to go here. We'll do this. We didn't have a church van. We had to find volunteers to drive us around. And so teaching the children that, hey, here's some projects you want to do. Hey, why don't we ever go so-and-so? Well, why don't you plan the trip? Well, how do I plan the trip? Well, you gotta make the reservations. You gotta find out the dates. You gotta find out the cost. And we'll advertise it. And if we do everything for the children, they learn that everything is done for them. And what happens then? So if you teach them to self-initiate, you look at how young adults used to look in college versus how young adults look in college now. College is an extension of high school. They're still dependent. When I went to college, I was 8.5 hours away from home. I drove myself to a place I'd never seen. I didn't have a GPS to take me there. I had $50 cash. The plan was eat on that till you got a job. And I drove away from home and lived on my own, slipping my car some. Broke curfew and rappelled out the windows, by the way. Climbed back up the side of the building with pizza. But that's another story for another day. And that rumor about me rappelling into the building dressed like Batman, that was false. I was dressed like Spider-Man. But anyway, it's just one of those things. But, you know, we went and we were in. So when we came home, instead of waiting for somebody to have a college ministry, we did our own thing because we were adults. Well, now our college kids expect us to plan and do and execute things for them just as well. And if we taught it at an earlier age, they would outgrow that. So number one, I'm capable. And then number two, I'm significant. That personal importance. You can't have a healthy Christian relationship with other people until you have a healthy relationship with yourself. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and control of the self. Self-awareness and self-control, super, super important. So when you get to the model that we talked about from 2 Thessalonians, or 1 Thessalonians, Paul said we encouraged, oh, look, I'm capable. I'm encouraging you to do things. I'm encouraging you to get out of your comfort zone. I'm encouraging you to do things that are difficult and hard. I believe in the theory of intentional adversity. I do things that you want so I can do things that you can't. And that's just a personal philosophy that I have. When I goof around with jiu-jitsu, it doesn't mean anything to me to go into a room and tap a bunch of people. I can leg lock my way through this room, because if you don't know leg locks, you just don't know leg locks. But when I go into a room and we do sometimes 6 minutes, sometimes we do 8 minute rounds. So you train, you learn a move, and then they start the clock and you wrestle with somebody for 8 minutes. The bell rings, you take a minute break, you wrestle with somebody for 8 minutes. And the bell rings, you wrestle with somebody for 8 minutes. And the longest I've done is 7 8-minute rounds. But when I do that, I'm not trying to beat Jason. I'll start that match and I'll let him get on top of me in the worst possible position I can be in. Because I'm not going to, if I have to go hands-on with somebody, I'm not going to wrestle anybody older than me. And I'm not going to wrestle anybody smaller than me. Okay? I get that. I put my hands on somebody, they're going to be twice my size, half my age. And if I start out on the bottom in trouble, and I can A, survive it, or flip it, I'm a pretty good wrestler. Intentional adversity. I'm going to do things that you won't do so I can do things you can't do. The only way to run faster is to run faster. And that just sucks, okay? You can get into I'm just jogging. And you can jog that the same pace the rest of your life and never get any faster. But you won't get any better shape either. And so you got to make yourself do some stuff. Wear a weighted vest, run up a hill, whatever. Same thing in life. I'm going to teach myself that I'm capable by putting myself in uncomfortable positions. And I do believe in logical consequences. Hey, it's youth night. You got to preach a sermon in front of the church, and this kid shows up and says, I'm not prepared. Then you say, well, I'm not going to let you stand in the pulpit and wing it. Or, like I did one time, I let him stand in the pulpit and I said, because standing in front of a group of people and opening your Bible and talking to them is a sacred responsibility. And if you treat it like you will a book report, you need to know what that feels like to crash and burn, especially when you've got people to catch you until you do better next time. But I believe in teach people I'm capable. And then the I'm significant goes into we encourage, and then what do? We comfort. So I'm significant, and Paul saying we comfort is how do we respond to our young people when they are in a crisis, either spiritual crisis or an emotional crisis. And what's the key word for teenage girls? Crisis, right? They love to be in crisis. Everything is a crisis. Everything, you know, is great. So when children get into crisis, your communication style with your children needs to be similar to God's communication style. We teach this thing with the police we call attunement. And it's that where your hand motions go from here to here. Well, guess who invented attunement? For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was on all points tempted like as we are, so that we can come to Him in the time of need for grace and mercy. God says, it's okay to walk into my throne and go, I'm a hot mess, because Jesus says, look, I was there. I had anxiety. I got hungry. I got tired. They talked about me my whole life because my parents weren't married when I was born. They lied about me. They betrayed me and they murdered me. So when I come to God, I say, God, God understands me from my perspective because he was a human. John chapter 1 verse 14, and the word became flesh and tabernacled among us. It's just fun to say tabernacled. It means a tent. He lived in a tent like you've got. So when my kids go into crisis or my daughter goes into crisis or the youth group goes into crisis, the first thing I want to do is not tell them how they should feel or how they shouldn't feel. I want to find out how they feel. Tell me what happened. The coach said this. Well, the coach said this and it made you mad, sad, angry. Yes. I like to use what Mark Goldston calls the empathy bomb. I bet you think nobody else understands how sad you are. You're right, I'm sad. I bet you think nobody else understands how frustrated you are. You're right, I'm frustrated. When you get your first yes, you've turned your conversation from this to this. And so basically I go, hey, tell me what happened. I repeat what they tell me, making sure I got all my facts straight. And then I superimpose the emotions. So they said this, they didn't say this, they did that, they didn't say that, and you feel mad, sad, happy, glad, disappointed, whatever. Yes, and when you keep getting those yeses, you're looking at their life the way they're looking at their life. Yeah, I'm not trying to say that I see it from your perspective. I'm not saying that I understand it completely. I'm not saying that I think it's reasonable. I don't think I'm saying that it's rational. I'm just saying I get you. You get called to Walmart and there's a dude standing in the middle of the aisle, he's throwing green beans. What are you doing? I'm throwing green beans at this big dragon. If you go that big red one, you go, there's two of them. No, you don't want to get involved in his delusion. You go, sir, I don't see a dragon. But I bet if you see a dragon, it scares you to death. You're right, it scares me to death. Well, you hadn't hit him yet. You keep hitting people with green beans. Now, the manager is either going to let them charge you with assault or he's going to trespass you. Or you can just walk out with me. Which one are we going to do? He knows, I know he's afraid. Guess what he's going to do? Here's a guy I trust. I'll walk out with him. So you ask your students when they go into crisis, what happened? And then after you ask them what happens, you ask them to explain what it means to them or about them. Because when things happen to us, we have implicit beliefs about what those things mean. And we do that because of the rules of engagement we have. A teenager is egocentric. Everything is about me, right? They don't walk by a window without looking at themselves. They don't pick up one of these things without doing this with duck lips, right? If everything is about you, then everything is also your fault. Mom and dad divorced and I called it because they argued about my grades. That person treated me bad sexually because I was provocative. This person bullied me because I'm not worthy. And they don't have the filter to understand that some of the definitions they come up with are inaccurate. Now, the longer you believe that, the further away from healthy living you get. You guys familiar with vectors? So if I'm aiming my rifle at the target and I click my dial for windage and I click it one click, at 100 yards it moves 1 inch. At 200 yards, it moves 2 inches. At 300 yards, it moves 3 inches. See how that works? At 1,800 yards, I'm killing people in the next county. Okay? I believe this about myself for 1 year, for 5 years, for 50 years. I'm not anywhere close to normal. And so we have to understand that children think that the way they perceive the world is the way everybody perceives the world because they're the only person who lives up here. Right? I know what I mean by love. I know what I mean by family. I know what I mean by vacation because it's from my perspective. So, hey, tell me what happened. Well, they did this. They said that. They didn't say this. They didn't say that. Cool. Okay. So that's your perspective. That's what happened. Tell me what it means to you or what it means about you. And when you are traumatized, and by the way, you don't get to pick what traumatizes you. Trauma is one of those interesting things that things that traumatize me wouldn't traumatize you. Things that traumatize you wouldn't traumatize me. It's super. I've had the weirdest, and I've been doing this for years. I've been a police chaplain for 31 years. And I've been in the deep end of it. You know, I cleaned those bodies off the school bus that wrecked over the overpass that you saw on CNN. I was at UAH when that lady shot the place up. And I dealt with a lady that was at the table that the gun touched her head and just didn't fire. I was there when the chief said, hey, Lonnie, you need to get this lady out of here. I said, why do I need to get her out of here? He said, because you're not wearing body armor. And if you drag her off this scene and you're in body armor, it looks bad on CNN. She knew her husband was upstairs dead. And she knew he was cold. And she wanted to go into a crime scene and put a blanket over him. And she wouldn't leave. And the cops were unwilling to drag her off. So I got the job. I picked up a crash helmet on 9/11. Had a head in it. I mean, I've seen some junk. 4 weeks ago now, we kicked in a door on a fentanyl dealer. We got this massive F-550 truck with armor, and it's got a ram on the front of it. And the SWAT guys put my podcast sticker on the ram. So if you get served a warrant by the SWAT team, the first thing that comes through your door is, Keep Me Up with Jones, the Lonnie Jones podcast adventure. You should rethink your life choices. We busted through the door. I'm sitting on the truck, and the radio pops and says, there's kids in here. Well, I roll off the truck, and this guy walks out and hands me this little black girl. And can't be a year old. Looked like they put 10 pounds of sugar in a 5-pound sack. You know, little fat, little sprigs. A guy with a machine gun hands her to me. I'm wearing class 2 body armor. I've got a helmet and a mask on. I got a tomahawk on my belt. I take that helmet off. I take that mask off. It's 1:30 in the morning. I'm standing in the street wearing body armor, singing to a little black girl. And I'm surrounded by men with machine guns. And it shows up every week. I dream about that little girl. Doc Najjar took a picture of me and her. I kept it on my phone. And it's just so incongruous to be holding this little girl surrounded by violence. And I'm armored up. And it was cold, and she snuggled up against my armor. And I'm out there singing. And there's strobe lights going off, police lights, and you see the shadows of men with guns. And for whatever reason, that sticks with me. So when somebody tells you something bothers me, you don't say, get over it. You say, oh, it bothers you. Because you really don't know why it bothers you. Okay? So when you're traumatized, and it can be anything, it says something about you. There's an implicit belief. And then it says something about the person who's involved with you. They're strong, they're mean, they're powerful, they can't be trusted. It says something about your past. I've always been this way. It says something about your future. I'll always be this way. And in religious circles, it says something about God. And most of those interpretations of how we see things are not accurate, especially when they happen to an immature person with a developing mind. So your kids do math, and they do math weird ways. And so you got to ask, hey, what happened to you? And what does it mean to you? And then once they talk through that, the next step is to say, well, if I saw it that way and I felt the way you felt, I'd react to it that way too. Now you've done three important things. Now they are heard, they are understood, and they are accepted. 70% of emotional communication is unheard, misunderstood, and rejected. So in crisis intervention, I'm just letting people know I heard you, I understood you, and I accept the way you feel. Now, sometimes you have that conversation. They go, well, you said if you saw it that way, how do you see it? Now the door's open. What happened? What does it mean to you? And does it mean what you think it means? But you wait for that. You got to. It's a slow process. You got to let them vent. You got to let them vomit verbally. You got to let them bounce through all their emotions before you ever get to the healing or the solving stage. But I've never been emotion dismissing. I've never been emotion denying, and I'm not emotion disapproving. This is what happened. This is how you saw it. If I saw it the way you saw it, I'd feel the way you feel. I would be mad, sad, angry, disappointed, whatever. And then I've connected. So if you read Mark Goldston's book, Just Listen, listening creates empathy. Empathy creates rapport, an invisible connection. Rapport creates influence, and influence leads to behavioral change. So when you start crisis intervention with your children, whether it's a breakup or a failure or whatever, those are the steps you do. So Paul says, we encourage, and then we comfort. And that's basically a real super quick look at cognitive behavioral therapy. Because the way you think affects the way you feel, will affect the way you behave. the way you behave affects the way you feel, the way you think. It's this triangle that goes all the ways. And then the last one is encourage, comfort, and urge. And urge is the part of it that I talk about discipline. I'm capable, I'm significant, and I influence what happens to me. Life's about choices. You get to choose whether you have good outcomes or bad outcomes, and it basically boils down to personal accountability. You know, when God talks about discipline in Hebrews 12, He says you should view suffering, any kind of suffering, as discipline. Because suffering involves a function of discipline. God says, don't do it. I do it. God doesn't rescue me from those circumstances. Now, God doesn't punish me, but God says, look, I mean what I say. Faith is not believing in God. Faith is believing God. Oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. Don't do it this way. If you do it this way, it hurts. And so when children learn, hey, when I say yes to this, I've said no to this. Or when I say yes to this, I've also invited its friends to the party. And that's what discipline is. I'm helping you learn through your choices. I'm going to rescue you from your consequences. I'm going to let you fail. I've got 2 degrees. I don't need another one. I took high school algebra. I'm not taking it again. Okay. I probably should have, but I didn't. So, you know, I'm going to, if they fail, they can't. I get it. But they need to fail so that they know that it's not my grades, it's not my diploma, it's not my degree, it's not my job, it's yours. All human behavior is adaptive. I do what I do the way I do it because it works for me on some level. I mean, as a kid, that's a weird thing. You know, a teenage boy will eat a worm if he thinks it'll impress a girl. It's highly dysfunctional, but there's an upside to it. She went, ooh, yuck, took my picture, talked to her friends about me. She's talking about me. Down the hatching. Okay, and we don't understand that, but everything we do is reward motivated. When my behavior cost me more than it cost you, I will reevaluate my behavior. That's it. Now, when you start thinking about discipline and boundaries and consequences, understand those boundaries and consequences cannot be punitive and they can't be vindictive. I'm not doing what I'm doing to change your behavior. I'm going to do this so Jason will do that. No, that's manipulation. I'm going to do what I do, and I really don't care about your behavior. I'm managing my response to your behavior. I'm not managing your behavior. Because in truth, you can't make anybody do anything. Right? They dig their heels in, they're not going to make good grades. They dig their heels in, they're not going to eat broccoli. They dig their heels in, they're not going to come in on curfew. Got it. Can't make it happen. But I can change the way I respond to it. And once you do that, when my behavior costs me more than it costs you, I'll reevaluate my behavior. And so when we start teaching our students, hey, you chose not to do this and you lost out on it, rather than fixing it for everybody, that's when we teach them, hey, I'm capable, I'm significant, and my choices affect my outcomes. Encourage, comfort, and now I'm urging, I'm disciplining. Discipline is putting stress in a relationship, so the result is growth. And that's kind of my song and dance for raising spiritually self-reliant children. Questions, comments, things I need to elaborate on or anything like that? Yes, but it's expensive. Been there. I'm in grandparent mode. I was supposed to speak in South Carolina when Gunner was born. Lonnie Beth Collins said, I've been to the doctor. The doctor says that I can't go home. They're going to get the baby tonight. So I called these folks in South Carolina. I said, I'm supposed to do a seminar for you guys. I'm supposed to get on a plane in 2 hours. I'm going to Georgia and watch this grandbaby. Now, as soon as we get booties on the ground, it's not that much further from Georgia to South Carolina. I'll just come over. I'll be there in time to do the thing. I'm just not going to use your plane ticket. They said, cool, see the grandbaby. So I go over there. Gunner didn't come till like 2 a.m. I go home and sleep an hour and a half. I get up, get in the car, and drive to South Carolina. Walk into the door with a parenting presentation. and said, I've been a grandfather for 6 hours. I don't believe any of this anymore. I just threw my papers in there and just let it snow. I'm in that mode. We eat Twinkies for breakfast and we spend money like it's going out of style. And you know, my answer is yes. Jackie calls me Jonesy. She never called me Lonnie. She never called me Lonzo. She calls me Jones or Jonesy. And the grandkids call me Jonesy. And when that little girl says, Papa Jonesy, can I? The answer is yes. It's awesome. But so no, I'm not coming to your house. I'm out of that phase of my life. Other questions? Well, you got to look at it from two different perspectives. One is, at some point, I'm not going to make it a competition between youth group and what this kid is good at. Because why is this kid good at it? It may be their ministry. So how can my youth ministry support and supplement her cheer squad? Hey, since you guys didn't get to go because you had to cheer, can we have the cheerleaders over? And can we show them the video from the weekend? Can we look at this? Hey, can I come over and sponsor the cheerleaders with a pizza dinner before they go to state competition? And instead of making it an either or, make it a both and. The elders at Maysville, when the boys went to the state tournament, they had church on Tuesday instead of Wednesday. Because we're not going to put the boys in a position to choose between church and basketball. We're going to say, we support your basketball, because if you end up being a college player, look how much influence for the church you have. And so they just kind of did that. The other thing, I learned this from Wayne Baker. Wayne Baker said, if you've, and I was young, so you guys know what a Rolodex is? Okay. The kids go, huh? Your contact list. Wayne Baker said, if you've got 30 kids in your youth group, get 30 Rolodex cards, put their name on them every 30 days, touch every 30 kids. And that's a phone call, a text. Hey, let's go get a milkshake. Hey, I'm going to do this. Come ride with me. And every kid in my youth group will get 1 hour of my time every 30 days. Now, if you come to class, if you go to Devo, if you go to camp, if you go to retreat, you're choosing to get extra time. So when the parent comes and says, you're not as involved with my kid, I said, no, your kid is not as involved with me. Because every kid in this youth group got my face this much time every cycle, 30 days, 60 days, 80 days, how many kids you got. And then I quit worrying about, I'm offering something, and if you want it, you'll come get it. And if you don't, and your parents don't encourage it, I'm not going to have my feelings hurt. If 45 kids come with me, we eat at McDonald's. If 3 kids come with me, we eat steak. And then they go home and say, hey, we were on a trip with Lonnie. He didn't even take the van. He took his truck. And we stopped and had Longhorn. Well, I'll go next time. Well, there's 90 of you. We're going to McDonald's. But I just made it that if you missed, you heard it from your friends that you missed. And those priorities change pretty quickly. And we grew up in an area and the kids were incredibly gifted athletically. And some of those guys are still influencing people for the church. Steve Webster played ball for UAH, and now he runs an elite basketball private club camp, and he's training young men. He's not training basketball players. Basketball is a byproduct of what he does in these young men's lives. And he's doing youth ministry without a church. He's doing youth ministry on a basketball court. And had I made him stop that because he couldn't go to CYC, who knows where he'd be, what he'd be doing. So I'm thinking, everybody's ministry doesn't have to look like mine. And so I try to find out, how can I use whatever this kid's involved in as, hey, I don't mind you missing my thing to go to cheer as long as you're a Christian leader in your cheer school. Now, if you're bringing them towards you or they're bringing you toward them, you got to be, and then you got to figure out. A kid called me and said, hey, Mr. Lonnie, and he's a high-level Division I catcher, baseball. His chest plate said, thou shalt not steal. It was awesome. He said, I want to go to CYC. He said, but I've got this minor tournament. He said, we'll win this tournament with or without me. I said, tell your coach what your priorities are, what you want to do. And so he called me back. He said, well, my coach said I could go. He said, when I come back, I've got to run da-da-da for missing. I said, you tell me how far you run, I'll run every step you run. And his coach said, I wish I had 100 kids who would choose something like this before baseball. He said, now if you miss, you got to pay the rent. But he said, I don't mind you going as long as you understand it's not personal, it's business. And so we ran our laps and we did our thing. So I think it's you find a balance there, and that's a totally radical view from my standpoint. Our daughter played Division I volleyball. She had a learning disability, and she wasn't going to finish school if she didn't play volleyball. She wasn't going to go to college if she didn't play volleyball. But she ended up getting a D1 scholarship and played volleyball. And who knows how many people she's influenced as a volleyball coach and a volleyball supporter and that kind of stuff. And, you know, there were some things that, you know, I was the youth minister and she missed some stuff for volleyball. You know, and Lonnie, how come, you know, your daughter didn't go to Freed? Well, Freed didn't talk to her. And I know if she played Division I, she could have played at Freed. No offense to Freed. I'll say the same thing about Harding and the same thing about Faulkner. But, you know, they paid her $58,000 to go to school. And the Christian school didn't even recruit her. So, anyway, bitterness shows. Anyway, but she met the guy she's married to, a very spiritual young man. She met, he played basketball for the same school she played volleyball for. And they got this beautiful little Christian family living in Dalton, Georgia. So she didn't need to go to Freed, Faulkner, or Harding. I prayed. I don't know how prayer works. I trust that it works. We prayed about it. It worked. Now who am I to go, well, God, that's not what I pray. I prayed about it. You handle it. I don't know how it works, but it works. Cool. Right, I see people running back and forth. I need to go to Cersei. I'm going to hush. Thank you guys for letting me be part of your weekend. Thank you guys for hosting this. And I've been a real pleasure to get to sit and talk youth minister shop with you for a little bit. And War Eagle. No.